Welcome to All Sides Weekend. I'm your host, Claire Roth. In a singing career that spanned from the mid-20s to the early 70s, Mahalia Jackson was known as the Queen of Gospel. Here's a little bit of her singing When I Wake Up in Glory. It first appeared on her 1954 debut album, which was titled, perhaps appropriately, The World's Greatest Gospel Singer.
Oh, when I awake, wake up, yeah.
Born in New Orleans, she moved to Chicago at just 16, and soon after she began her music career. A play by Verna Green commemorates those early years. It's called Haley, and the Lincoln Theater will feature two performances tomorrow. Find out more about that on our website, WOSU.org. The Reverend Verna Green joins us now by phone. Welcome to the program, Verna.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be with you this morning.
Absolutely. So there are so many talented gospel singers. There's Sandy Patty, the Clark sisters, even Aretha Franklin. Why write a play about Mahalia?
Well, Mahalia Jackson has always fascinated me. I wrote a play years ago in 1990 called Rejoice, and it was the history of Black gospel music. Mahalia Jackson was one of the artists that I featured in the play, and after doing research and just discovering at age 16 she had such a strong conviction to sing only gospel music, she fascinated me because she was 16 years old. And I decided about a year ago to just write a short piece for Black History Month, about her and just talk about her younger years. That's why I called the play Haley, because that's what she was called when she was young. And it kind of zoomed from there. As I was developing the piece, I thought it extended further than just a Black history piece at our church, not to demean that, but I said, well, wow, I write plays. I've been on stages, taking my work to different places. Let's try Haley as a big production piece. And so far, it's proven to be something that people want to hear, and it's very enjoyable, if I have to say so myself. I think that it's very informative. And very enjoyable because there's a lot of good music. A lot of the music I've written myself, so it's not songs that you're going to tie in with Mahalia Jackson, but they're songs that tell about her storyline.
Yeah, you focus on her early years. Tell us about her life in New Orleans just a little bit before she ended up moving.
Well, she lived in a house that was full of family. It was 13 family members in three rooms in New Orleans. I think it's called the Carrollton section of New Orleans. And she was under a very strong disciplinarian, which was her Aunt Duke. And I don't focus a lot on Aunt Duke because there were things that Aunt Duke that we learned later that, we really don't want to talk about that. She was very mean. She was very mean. She was very strict, and Mahalia's mother died when she was 5, so she was left in the care of Aunt Duke and this big household, well, big family in a small household setting. And she was there until she was 16 years old and made up in her mind, her and her Aunt Hannah, that they were going to leave and go to Chicago. I don't know if they called it the Windy City then, but go to the big city because she was trying to fulfill a prophetic word on her life by one of her aunties called Belle. And Belle had said that one day you will sing before royalty. You will sing before great men. And that's where she found that to come to pass, and it was in Chicago.
So it was clear that she had that talent very early on.
Oh, yes. Very clear. Yes,
well,
very.
I want to introduce Mark Burford. He's the author of the 2018 book, Mahalia Jackson in the Black Gospel Field. He's also a professor of music at Reed College. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So, help us contextualize the start of Mahalia's career in that moment in history. She moved to Chicago. She was 16, and it was in the midst of the Great Migration, right?
Yeah, it's interesting to hear Reverend Green refer to history in the way her musical kind of recounts that history, because in some ways, Mahalia Jackson's family history is a quintessential African-American story. And the fact that her grandparents were born into slavery in the Pointe-Coupee Parish in central Louisiana, emancipated there, migrated from rural Louisiana to urban Louisiana and New Orleans, and then subsequently Mahalia Jackson joins the Great Migration from New Orleans to Chicago. So in a lot of ways, her family story sums up a lot of African-American history, particularly African-American from the South. And she also, I think, in that period was really part of many transitions when she moved to Chicago, part of the transition from sheet music to recordings, the transition from radio to television, even the onset of the civil rights movement and the Cold War. So really the mobility of Jackson, not only physically moving from place to place, but also being able to navigate different audiences is a big part of her story.
Mm. And Verna, you focus on those early years. Once she gets to Chicago, she's almost immediately, you know, discovered. Tell us about what you're featuring in your play, what her, you know, between 16 and 25, what those years were like for her.
Okay, between 16 and 25, she wasn't discovered immediately. She met Thomas Dorsey, who was very instrumental in getting her into the mainstream of gospel. Back at that time, Thomas Dorsey was, they called him Professor Thomas Dorsey. He was like the godfather of gospel music. So once she met his acquaintance, and she had been in Chicago for 13 years before that happened. That wasn't until 1929. So when she was in New Orleans, she was scrubbing floors and doing whatever 16-year-olds or girls of that age would do just to keep, you know, things afloat in the household. And when she moved to Chicago, she found herself doing the same thing for many years. She sang in funeral homes, which was very common then, brings in a little income, and she had concerts that she sponsored herself. And that's what I tell in my play, Haley, are the things that happened, like you said, between age 16 and 29 before she met Thomas Dorsey. Now, we do introduce Thomas Dorsey. We have an excellent actor, Carlton Fellows, that portrays Thomas Dorsey. So we show that blend, and we show that relationship, that strong relationship that they had. But for 13 years, she was, I'm sure, discouraged. But the thing about Mahalia, because she was such a great singer, she didn't want to do anything, well, refused to do anything other than gospel music. So even after she met Thomas Dorsey and began to go into a pretty stirring career, she still refused to sing anything like jazz or blues or any other genre other than gospel music. So she kept her stand. And that's what I'm conveying in Haley is determination, faith, family, motivation, perseverance, all of those things that actually made her Mahalia Jackson instead of little just Haley Jackson. So I tell more about Haley because it's not a lot, and I'm sure the professor probably knows this also. It's not a whole lot told between those lean years, between, I'll say, 5 and 29 when she was discovered, but I took what I had, you know, took what I had researched and embellished it. And I'm going to be very honest, it is a creative nonfictional piece. So there are characters that I've added to embellish it for the stage. So everything is not, it's true to fact as far as the history, but the characters, because it was 13 people, so I created a few people, interesting people in the household. Mm. But the story really tells about Mahalia and her relationship and the type of relationship she had individually with the characters that I've created. And then there's some true life characters, all the aunties that I have in the play Haley were actually the aunties that I learned about in my research.
Mark, you wrote a whole book on Mahalia. Did you find that to be true, that meeting Thomas was kind of that tipping point for her?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, because, one other aspect that I was going to add about her early life is the question of class. That was a real point of anxiety and focus for her. I mean, growing up in New Orleans, she was in the part of New Orleans, in uptown New Orleans, known as what's known today as the Black Pearl, but it was a very sequestered neighborhood pressed against the train tracks and the Mississippi River. And it was in some ways predominantly Black, but also very mixed with Italian immigrants and German immigrants. So she was already in her early life navigating this kind of working class environment. But of course, New Orleans is very stratified class-wise as well, too. So I think that even among the African-American community, you had elite African-Americans. And I think Jackson would have felt herself to have been growing up and knew herself to be growing up
impoverished area in an impoverished community. Oh, I think we lost Mark, but we'll get him back in just a moment. You know, Verna, I want to talk and hear a little bit more of Jackson's voice. We have here her singing Wait Until My Change Comes. This is a single off of her 1959 album, which was titled Dig a Little Deeper. Wow. That voice is just so beautiful, Verna.
Yes, it is. It's so full of gusto. And a lot of people back in, well, in that day, you didn't hear a young woman singing with such gusto and fire and fervor. And she's an untrained singer. She's an untrained singer. Didn't read sheet music, as Professor was saying. She didn't read sheet music. She just went for what she knew and just belted it out. And it was amazing, and that voice remained amazing. You know, I think she passed in 1972, and I didn't come to know Mahalia Jackson, actually, until I was, oh, my God. I say come to know her, come to realize the magnitude that she had carried in her career until I was, like, in my teens. But my grandmother was a big fan of Mahalia Jackson.
Well, you say she wasn't classically trained.
No.
Was it just that singular talent that made her so successful, or was there something else in that formula that really meant this breakout success for her?
I think it was just that raw talent that she wasn't like signature beats. A lot of times when singers are singing, and you have to know signatures, especially if you're singing with a trained musician accompanying you, they want you to sing according to how the song is written. She many times would go off score because she just was raw. How she felt it is how she delivered it. And I think that that was one of the driving points in why her career did take off like it did. It was amazing. It was amazing because she always came out on top, but she did it. She did it her way. Wow. She did it her way, and so much power. You know, even until her latter years, I've never heard a song by Mahalia Jackson that wasn't forceful.
Yeah, you can feel the soul in it. I think is something that you really can tell is that she is feeling those words. It's not just a performance for her. It is, you know, in a way, probably a prayer and an expression of her inner self and of her faith.
Sure, and what she came through, as the professor was saying, she came through some really hard times coming up. It was hard. They didn't have if you look at a household with 13 people, so you know it was very sparse.
Mm.
So that helps to build. That builds character in you, and it probably just tied in with her voice, with her talent, and produced the sound that we were accustomed to hearing from her.
Well, Reverend Verna Green, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Oh, thank you for having me. Thank you so very much. I've enjoyed it.
Reverend Verna Green is the playwright behind Haley. It's premiering in Columbus tomorrow at the Lincoln Theater. Find out more at WOSU.org/AllSides. This is All Sides Weekend. We'll be back in just a moment.
WOSU Public Media's newest podcast series, Rivet, young people share their unique pathways to professional success. Listen to This American Graduate Project. Find Rivet now in WOSU's mobile app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides Weekend on 89.7 NPR News. I'm your host, Claire Roth. This hour, we're talking about gospel music and the so-called queen of gospel, Mahalia Jackson. She was the first gospel singer to perform at Carnegie Hall and one of the only women on stage at the Second March on Washington in 1963. This weekend, a production of Haley, a play about Jackson's early years, takes the stage at the Lincoln Theater. Find out more at WOSU.org/allsides and feel free to join the conversation. If you have a particular gospel song that's near and dear to your heart, if you've listened to Mahalia Jackson and been moved by her, we want to hear from you. Call us at 614-292-8513 or send us an email, allsides@WOSU.org. Back on the line with us is Mark Burford. He's the professor of music at Reed College and the author of the 2018 book, Mahalia Jackson and the Gospel Field. Thank you again for being with us, Mark.
My pleasure.
So from what I've read at the time, some people criticized Jackson. She said she was bringing jazz into church. Did her version of gospel music differ wildly from what was already accepted?
Well, I think one of the things to know about Jackson is that she had a range of musical influences. She grew up Baptist in New Orleans, but she also visited regularly a sanctified church that was near her home, which had more ecstatic styles of worship. So that definitely shows up in her style of worship. Interestingly, she also listened to a lot of records and listened to a lot of classical recordings as well, too. She listened to Marian Anderson and Roland Hayes, African-American recitals. Even white opera singers like Grace Moore and Lawrence Tibbett. So she really had broad musical interests. So I think when she showed up in Chicago, there was that element of Pentecostal, ecstatic performance that I think a lot of button-down Baptists were a little bit more skeptical about. And she actually remembered throughout her life how she was received in those early years by Black Baptists. And so I think she saw herself as a triumphalist story of how her style of music, this modern gospel style, kind of won out in the end.
That's really fascinating to me because obviously gospel music has existed for centuries, I think has roots in the 17th century. But was it just becoming popular in a wider way when Mahalia, was rising to fame?
Well, I think you have to distinguish between gospel songs, which are kind of a generic category for a certain kind of religious song in the U.S., from the Black gospel movement that Dorsey kind of initiated in the 30s. And it was a really purposeful movement on his part. He was a songwriter, and he was writing songs that were kind of trying to incorporate a new aesthetic into the music. So he formed an organization, the National Convention of Gospel Choirs and Choruses, and really sought to market his songs through Black gospel choirs, really invented the gospel choir, the Black gospel choir in the 1930s. I think the thing about Jackson is that she shifts from a kind of economy of gospel songs sold as sheet music to gospel performance that circulates on records. Mm. So one of the transitions that she's part of is really up to that point, gospel singers didn't really, except for gospel male gospel quartets, but women soloists, for instance, didn't really record that much. It wasn't really until 1948 with the break of Move On Up a Little Higher that people, as Jackson herself put it, that you could sing songs the way you sing them in the church, put them on record, and people will buy them. And that was a real breakthrough. And so gospel performance as opposed to gospel songs really become the economy of gospel music during that time.
We have a call from Terry in Youngstown. Terry, what would you like to share about Mahalia?
Yes, my first introduction to Mahalia when I saw the movie *Imitation of Life*, and she sang at the end the funeral scene, and she sang "Trouble the World," and that was really emotional. And she became good friends with Lana Turner at that time because Lana was going through some trouble with her daughter, and Lana was very apprehensive meeting this religious woman, thinking she would look down on her, but Mahalia didn't. She helped her, Lana, during her troubled time with her daughter.
Well, thank you so much for that comment. I really appreciate you calling in and sharing your feelings about Mahalia in this movie. And Mark, that's something you brought up earlier, where she was really on the cusp of a lot of transitions, including from radio to TV.
Yeah, I think, and it's interesting that the caller brings up Imitation of Life, because that's a moment where gospel is appearing in this pop cultural setting, in this Hollywood movie. And one of the things I kind of try to unpack in the book is this kind of paradox of Mahalia Jackson. On the one hand, she's exemplary. She's the queen of gospel. She is an exemplar of the style and kind of is a stand-in for the gospel field. On the other hand, she achieved a level of fame and celebrity and visibility and pop cultural cachet that made her exceptional within the field. And I think from her career from the late 50s on, there is this kind of awkward framing of Mahalia Jackson, because she's performing on the Ed Sullivan Show, she's performing on the Johnny Cash Show, she's in these movies, and thinking about how she fits within the gospel field. And that's one of the things I try to do in the book, is how do we account for Jackson's unique position, yet think of gospel music, the gospel field, as a kind of, maybe not holistic, but a kind of a broader spectrum of possibility.
Hmm. I hate to go too long without actually hearing from Mahalia herself, so let's listen to a little bit of another song from her. This one is called Jesus Is With Me.
Jesus is with me.
Jesus is with me.
Oh, yes, when I need him more. Jesus is with me.
Jesus is with me.
Oh, Lord,
when I need him more.
When I've gone to my extreme, all my work and pain, it seems, then my Jesus steps
right in, Lord.
So, of course, this is very straightforwardly a Christian song. It's centered there. And you were talking earlier about her straddling these two worlds, you know, being in pop culture, but still very much being a gospel singer. And unlike, say, Aretha Franklin, she always refused to sing secular music. Do we know why that was?
Well, I think it was because she had a responsibility, or felt a responsibility, and also kind of was under the eagle eye of the Baptist Church. But one of the interesting things about Mahalia Jackson is that, you know, though she said she always sang, as she put it, Christian music in Christian places, there was some fudging. For instance, I talk a lot about how she was multimediated. She was a recording artist, but she also had her own radio show, which debuted in 1954. She had a TV show that was a nationally broadcast radio show. She also had a TV show in 1955 that was broadcast in Chicago. And on that show, she occasionally had to sing songs that were not religious songs. She sang sentimental parlor songs from the 19th century. She sang not pop songs, but songs that originated in musicals. You'll Never Walk Alone, which is vaguely religious. She sang Danny Boy and songs like that. So there were instances where she was kind of branching out and singing songs that were originated as love songs. But she, as one writer talked about, she made them all sound religious, even if they weren't. Putting it in her voice. So she sang at the Newport Jazz Festival. So there was, I mean, it's a more complex story than she resolutely refused. I think she resolutely refused to see herself and present herself as a secular singer, but the repertory and venues sometimes were a little bit more flexible.
Well, this leads well into a question I've been meaning to ask, which is, how does gospel music, how has it influenced other genres that are more secular in nature?
Well, I think in the 50s you start seeing gospel singers who began as gospel singers crossing over into popular music. Obviously, Sam Cooke was a kind of trailblazer in that regard. He started out with a gospel quartet called the Soulsters and left the Soulsters and sang popular music, and of course had his big hit with You Send Me in 1957. So voices themselves, black gospel voices, were crossing over into popular music, so you start seeing that resonance. And I think that's one of the biggest legacies of gospel music, because really, if you think about popular singing today, it's hard to imagine popular singers who aren't really influenced by that very melismatic, kind of those runs in singing, this kind of open-throated, kind of ecstatic type of singing. That's indebted to gospel. So in some ways, gospel
singing has become a lingua franca of popular singing. So that's one impact. I think a more complicated impact is that there's kind of a double reception of gospel and the black church. On the one hand, the black church for African Americans, there's a sense of intimacy. It's a space of refuge, a space of solidarity. It's a space where civil rights aspirations were strategized. So there's a real intimacy of African Americans with the black church, even if people aren't even nominally religious. On the other hand, I think the black church and gospel music for a lot of white Americans has been a space of intrigue and fascination. There's always been this going back to the antebellum South and whites watching black churches and watching them worship. There's always been a fascination. So it's an interest. There's a perpetual othering of the black church and a space. So it's a meeting point, I think, for black and white sensibilities about African Americans in society and gospel aesthetics. So it's an interesting, complicated, and I think unstable space in some ways in terms of racial reconciliation.
Well, and if I'm not mistaken, and I forget the exact name of it, there's a Hall of Fame for gospel singers, but it's almost all white singers. Mahalia Jackson's one of the only black singers that's actually in it.
Well, that's why the title of the book is Mahalia Jackson and the Black Gospel Field, because even though there was some repertory shared, and even though the larger category, gospel songs, extends back to the 19th century, there is a distinction, some would say a fiction, but a distinction between white gospel, which is sometimes referred to as Southern gospel, and black gospel. And it was remarkably, I wouldn't even say segregated. I think there were just two complete different worlds that had similar forms. There were black quartets and white quartets. So it makes sense in some ways that there would be a gospel hall of fame that really is for Southern gospel, though there is in the works a black gospel hall of fame and museum that's in the works in Chicago as well. So they are kind of parallel, but perhaps not as much intersecting as we might expect worlds of gospel.
I'd like to know more about Mahalia Jackson's intersection with the civil rights movement. I mean, she was there during the Montgomery bus boycott, if I'm not mistaken, right?
She was. And this is a really interesting aspect of her, because her political sensibilities, I think, go all the way back to New Orleans. I mean, we think about the new Negro Renaissance of the 1920s and equate it with the Harlem Renaissance. But really, it was a national movement. So she was, even in New Orleans, there was a black newspaper called the Louisiana Weekly which circulated stories about Harlem Renaissance associated themes, Marcus Garvey's being written about in that newspaper. So she's exposed to that. One of her school teachers was the editor of the paper. So she was involved with politics in Chicago with early campaigns as early as the 30s. So it wasn't a kind of moment of epiphany in the 50s when she gets involved with the Montgomery bus boycott and was very involved with the Southern Christian Leadership Council and was very close friends with King. But she was already involved with that in Chicago from the 1930s. So she'd always been a kind of proud race woman. She was an entrepreneur. And so her civil rights activities were visible in terms of the March on Washington, but also more subtle, the way she thought about self-help and saw herself as a businesswoman in the community.
This is perhaps a more amorphous question, but what do you think that gospel music, like her singing at the March on Washington in 63, what do you think that added to the movement?
Well, I think it's an interesting moment, because it's very typical in black churches before the minister speaks. There's the kind of pre-sermon number that a singer will render, and the purpose of that is to kind of prepare the congregation, to kind of fertilize the spiritual soil, in a sense, for the sermon that's to come. And black ministers are very particular about who they want to do that. And it's very important to recognize that Jackson didn't just sing at the March of Washington. She sang just before King spoke, and he wanted it that way. So in some ways, there's a kind of microcosm of a kind of black church practice that happens even in that spectacular setting of the at the foot of the Lincoln Memorial. And King, in fact, wrote Jackson a telegram after the March on Washington saying exactly that, saying that many people said this is my finest hour, and if it was, it was because that you sang before me, that if I was successful, it was because of you, and when I got up, I was ready to preach, and that sort of thing. So King acknowledged Jackson's impact on him. It's an amazing telegram to read. So he acknowledged that her inspiration before he got up and gave that that watershed speech was important for him in terms of nourishment to address that crowd.
Man, that gives me chills, honestly. I'd be remiss not to mention there's a new documentary. It's about a live gospel concert that Aretha Franklin performed decades ago. It's just now hitting theaters. Here's just a little bit of her singing Amazing Grace. Help us understand Jackson's influence on Franklin.
Well, I think Jackson had an influence on I think singers that followed in a number of ways. One, the fact that she was able to be herself and kind of present gospel as you would hear it in the church in public and have that be received and that not be something to be ashamed of. King said that too, that she taught African Americans how to be proud of their culture. So the fact that Aretha would sing a piece like this, obviously in the black church, but bring that style of singing into her own secular recordings as well, too. This particular song, Amazing Grace, it's the way it's sung in that slow, there's no beat or real sense of tempo. That was a song that Jackson herself recorded and kind of popularized in that kind of, it's what's called a Dr. Watts kind of lined out slow hymn style. So it's very much indebted in that way. But you hear her influence the sound of her voice in other singers like Mavis Staples. I hear you listen to some early Mahalia Jackson records and it almost sounds like a preview of what you'd hear in Mavis Staples. So I think Jackson's just her voice and the way she was able to, as I said, just bring a certain kind of aesthetics, a black aesthetics rooted in gospel music to virtually any repertory. And I think that model is exactly what Aretha does in those Atlantic recordings where she's basically singing secularized gospel music in a way.
Wow. Mark Burford, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Mark Burford is a professor of music at Reed College. He's also the author of the 2018 book, Mahalia Jackson and the Black Gospel Field. We have to let him go. Unfortunately, he's got a lecture to run off to. But we will be back with more coming up in just a few moments on All Sides Weekend here on 89.7 NPR News. Good morning. You're listening to All Sides Weekend on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Claire Roth. Haley, a play about Mahalia Jackson's early years, takes the stage at Lincoln Theater tomorrow. Find out more about it at WOSU.org/allsides. The gospel singer was renowned for her contralto voice, and though she died in the early 70s, her legacy lives on in gospel and non-gospel music genres alike. Emma Easton directs the Gospel Vocal Ensemble at Columbus State Community College, and she joins us now to discuss it. Welcome to the program, Emma.
Thank you, Claire. I'm so excited about being here today.
Oh, gosh, I'm so excited to have you. You've been performing gospel literally your whole life, right?
My entire life, since I was born.
What draws you to the genre? What do you love about it?
Well, I love the energy of the genre. And I love the fact that it changes the lives of people, because usually once people hear the gospel music or hear gospel music, it changes their perspective even on life.
How do you figure?
Well, because if they're downtrodden or they're going through a problem or a struggle or situation, then once they hear the gospel, they hear joyous music. They hear joyous lyrics. They hear lyrics of a message of hope. And it just inspires them to keep going if they are about to give up.
It's funny you say that. When I was reading about Mahalia Jackson for this show, she had a quote that said, you know, I don't like singing the blues because at the end of singing the blues, you still have
the blues.
Exactly.
Yes.
But gospel music to her lifted her up. It brought her to a new plane.
That's right.
So you've been singing it since you were a kid because your dad sang gospel music, right?
Yes, my dad, Levi Pryor, Sr., was the first person who introduced me to gospel music. And before I could even walk good, my dad was teaching me how to sing. And then once I started getting to a point where I could read, then he started teaching me and my siblings how to read music.
Wow. So you learned how to read notes at the same time as you were learning how to read letters.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Tell us about your choir at CSCC. When did you start directing it? What's it composed of?
Well, my choir at Columbus State is composed of a lot of different people from a lot of different communities, a lot of different areas. I started directing there. I was appointed as director in 2006, so I've been there for 13 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. And it has we have young people as young as 16. We actually had a 13-year-old that came to us last term that wanted to be a part of the gospel choir.
Wow.
And he wanted it primarily, and his parents wanted it so that it would help him with his low self-esteem. And then I have seniors. So, and I have all ethnicities that participate in the gospel choir.
It's when I think of a gospel choir, I mm-hmm. think of usually a church,
yes.
But yours is tied to a college instead. Can you help us understand that? Where's the distinction?
Yes. And most people, when they think in terms of gospel music, they associate it with the church.
Yeah.
Now, with the college, it is a course. It's actually a course that people can take. It's music to 1206, and they can actually get credit if they enroll in the course. And we also accept community participants. The difference being is that we are able to go on to various platforms that church choirs actually may not be able to go.
Mm. And you teach it then. How
yes.
does teaching that differ from teaching any other genre of music?
Well, it's relatively the same, except for, just I work more in helping to convey the message that, and to ensure that the singers understand the message and that it's a heartfelt message that they're delivering, because they cannot deliver it and help other people get delivered unless they feel it themselves first.
Mm. So there's a real emotional and spiritual aspect to it.
Absolutely. It has to be emotional, spiritual. And sometimes I'll tell them to reach way back. Maybe there was a hurt or something that they experienced in their lives. And so let those lyrics and the message of that music, you know, resonate in your spirit first, you know, and you get healed or you get delivered through the message before you deliver it to others.
Well, we have to listen to some of this. We can't just talk about it.
Thank
so
you.
Let's hear a little bit of your choir singing the song, I've Never Seen the Righteous Forsaken.
Say what?
I'm sorry.
No, I understand. If I had any sort of voice at all, I'd want to sing along as well.
I don't have one. I consider myself a necessary singer. I only sing when it's absolutely necessary.
Okay, I understand. But I think it's interesting because that obviously sounds a lot more modern than what we've been listening to for the rest of the hour, which
yes.
makes sense. What we've been listening to was created in the mid last century.
Yes.
How would you say gospel music has evolved as a genre, you know, since 1950, since Mahalia Jackson was popular?
Well, I think technology is one thing that has helped gospel music to evolve, because now we have the ability to integrate various sounds that we may not have been able to integrate before. And so I hate to put it like this, but some of the sounds that are used in secular music as well, you know, are integrated now into gospel music. And then the other thing is about with gospel incorporates or embodies all the other genres. So you may have gospel jazz, you know, gospel, rap, gospel, whatever other genre that's out there, you know, gospel can actually embody those styles as well.
It's about the message in some ways.
It's about the message. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, in an increasingly secular country, in
yes.
an increasingly secular world, do you think that gospel music is losing its relevance?
I would think that it, in some circles, it may be losing relevance.
You got
okay,
it.
Did I say that correctly?
Yeah, you got
okay,
it.
Okay, thank you. But I think that it is still very much prevalent, you know, in a lot of communities, and that I've noticed even with the Gospel Vocal Ensemble, when we actually go out into the community and we sing our songs, how people who may not even be looking for some kind of a change or excitement or expecting anything, that they're singing with us. Last night we did a concert and we were at a cafe singing. And so and most of the people there were from the community. And so midway through the concert, I thought, let me ask them if they have any songs that they want to request. And so they started throwing songs to us that they wanted us to sing. And by the end of the concert, everybody in the hall, the cafe area, which was pretty large, they were up singing with us and, you know, moving and dancing to the music. And you could, and as we were leaving, one lady even said to me, she said, thank you so much
wow.
for coming.
Wow.
So I think it's still relevant. You know, you just have to find the right avenue or the right vein in which to work in.
Well, you mentioned that you asked for requests.
Yes.
Tell us, how much of these are almost standards? Are they hymns?
Yeah.
How does it work, I guess?
Yes. One of the things I've noticed is that if we go into a senior center and I ask for any requests, we always get the hymns. Sometimes we'll get to the spirituals as well, a request for spirituals. So last night we got a request for a hymn, and we also got a request for a modern day gospel song, which was by Fred Hammond. So, yes, I think, you know, even reaching back, I make sure that the choir at Columbus State is well versed, so that if we get a request, that we can honor those requests and then also minister to the needs of the people that we are serving.
We have been talking this hour about singular vocalists. Mahalia Jackson, Aretha Franklin's another obvious example. How do you see the relationship between these kind of breakout stars, so to speak, and between a classic group effort of a choir?
Well, I think that it's important. I think that one of the things that is most important about it is that the camaraderie that happens within a choir helps to provide support. And let's say, for instance, a solo artist may not feel up to par, per se, and or might not be feeling, you know, the entire message because they may or may not have written their own music. So I think that the choir embodies support. You know, so that if one is not feeling it, they yell out and they shout out, you know, go ahead, sing it. And I'm not putting down solo artists, but I think that they have they can be just as effective as the choir.
Well, and you have a production company that helps solo artists launch their careers, right?
I certainly do.
So you're not putting them down. What do you look for? I mean, what's important to you when you're looking for that sort of artist?
Well, I'm looking for passion. That's the first thing. I'm looking for them to have a passion about what they're singing about, what they want to do, what they hope to accomplish, and that they're not going to be what I consider a quote-unquote lazy artist, that they're willing to get out there and work. My husband always says that I'm a hustler, you know, and someone else coined the phrase that I'm the hardest working gospel artist person in Columbus. I don't know about all of that. But, you know, I look for some of those same traits and those same qualities. You got a passion. You're willing to work, you know, and then that you do have some kind of talent.
Sure. A vocal talent, of course.
A vocal talent. Yes.
Being able to access that.
Absolutely.
I'm curious about the Columbus scene. You mentioned that someone called you the hardest working person in gospel here in Columbus. Tell us, what is the gospel scene like here in Central Ohio?
Well, it has grown significantly since I started my music production company, Jamco, in 1994. And part of the reason why I started it was because there wasn't a lot of gospel activities going on. There weren't platforms for gospel artists to actually present their talent outside of the church walls. So my focus has been more on outreach and non-traditional venues. Just like Thomas Dorsey's music was not accepted inside of the church, some of the talent that I wanted to present at that time was not accepted inside of the church, one being gospel rap or gospel hip hop. And I was probably one of the first or trailblazers as far as presenting gospel hip hop to the church scene. So that was my purpose, again, was that, and to also to help young artists that wanted to get started.
Before I let you go, we have to listen to at least a little bit more from your choir. Here's another song. It's called I Can Rely. Wow.
Yes.
That voice.
That was Vanessa J.
Oh, my gosh.
One of the solo artists that I produced.
Well, that song is an original song.
Yes.
And I'm curious, what are the building blocks of writing a gospel song?
Well, and because I write a lot of the music that the choirs sing and also that the solo artists sing, like the one you just heard, the building blocks pretty much consist of it may be something, a trial or a situation that I'm going through. And that I feel that, you know, my experience can help someone else. So it's a testimonial kind of song and showing you how you can get out of the problem or overcome the obstacle that you're going through.
Mm.
And just, you know, putting that together. And usually the lyrics come to me first and then the music. And because I'm also a musician and I can play, then usually the melody will come after that, after I get the lyrics.
Mm. And do you think about having a vocalist and then the way that the choir will almost support them and layer in with their voice?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm. It plays a major part.
For people who aren't religious, is there something still in gospel music for them?
Yes. And it was when I was in grad school getting my master's degree, I had one of my fellow students said to me, I like gospel music. I just don't want to go to church to hear it.
Huh.
And that struck a chord in me. Mm-hmm. And so that's what also helped me as far as, you know, doing more of the outreach things that I did and realizing that there were people out there who weren't necessarily religious or got, but they enjoyed the music.
For people who aren't religious, don't feel comfortable going to a church, where can they find gospel music here in Columbus?
There's a lot of different activities that are going on, and that's part of the reason why I said it has evolved since I started in 1994 with Jamco. There's a lot of different, there's now gospel comedy shows that they can go to. There's Gospel on the Riverfront. The Columbus Gospel Fest is coming up in July.
Yeah.
So they can definitely experience it down on the riverfront. I used to host, for 11 years, I hosted the Gospel Celebration down on the riverfront with in conjunction with the Columbus Santa Maria. So there are all kinds of different avenues, and they can always check out Eventbrite or something like that.
Sure.
To find gospel happenings.
Well, Emma Easton, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.
Emma Easton is the director of the Gospel Choir at Columbus State Community College. We've been talking about gospel and Mahalia Jackson all hour long. You can find out more at our website about a play going on tomorrow about Jackson's early life. Go to WOSU.org/All Sides. This has been All Sides Weekend. The All Sides staff includes producer Mary Lee Williams, assistant producer Kyle McKinnon, All Sides interns Ray Brewster, Maisie Glockner, Sophie Warner, with video production by Rich and Amber Blue. Thank you so much for listening to All Sides Weekend today. You can like us on Facebook at All Sides. Follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. I'm there as well at Claire Alice Roth. Hope you have a wonderful weekend.